Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 14. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Ben Flanagan of Aspect Radio.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Ben.
So, it's summer movie season has started, and we wanted to talk a little bit about disappointing summer movies. So let's each kind of give maybe like two or three and kind of talk about when our hearts were broken at the what should be the most fun time of the year at the movies. I'll let you go first.
Well, it's hard to pick just a few because, I mean, it happens a lot. I mean, it happened a lot over the years because, A, I saw a lot of movies, and B, Hollywood whiffed several times. And it really hurt the most, I think, when it was at the start of the summer movie season. So the May movies that really disappointed are the ones that stick out the most to me. And I'll start with 2001, the noted, notoriously terrible summer movie season that started out with a movie that I was really looking forward to. It was The Mummy Returns, the sequel to The Mummy from 1999, which was just an excellent adventure movie, surprisingly from Stephen Sommers, that just blended action-adventure, an old serial sensibility, and a lot of visual effects so seamlessly, and a lot of good humor, too. And I was just ready for round two. I hadn't quite gotten super jaded by sequels at that point, and I was just on board. I loved the first one so much, and I just couldn't wait for them to go bigger and better with all of the same characters and actors and trying to take it up a notch with the special effects and the action set pieces. And what happened was a crap sandwich that afternoon, whichever dad, and it might have been opening day that I saw it with my brother Graham, and the visual effects were just too much. The humor was missing a beat, and the whole story just felt out of sorts for me, and it just didn't work at all. Like, I'm sure it didn't work for a lot of people. And then just one of the worst pieces of CGI in movie history, when the Rock, the Scorpion King, appears as this hybrid man scorpion thing, and it just started the summer off with such a sour note. And it's the first one I can really think of that made me feel terrible and started to jade me about sequels.
Yeah, I mean, it's a surprise his career got past that, because that was terrible. One of mine is from that summer, too. I'm a huge fan of Jurassic Park. I'm a huge fan of The Lost World. So when it was time for a third round in that same summer of 2001, even though I knew that it wasn't going to be Spielberg, that it was going to be Joe Johnston taking over, I like Joe Johnston. He did The Rocketeer. And so I was as hyped for that movie as I was for The Lost World. I took the day off of work to go see it. I think it may have been like my birthday. I didn't want to take anybody with me because I didn't want anybody to talk. So I went by myself. I lost money because I took off work to go see Jurassic Park 3. And a few weeks before it, I had this nightmare that the series jumped the shark by introducing like this cave boy character that's like a caveman brought back to life through, you know, John Hammond's technology, like there were hardly any dinosaurs in my nightmare, and it was just like this little cave boy running around making jokes, so whenever I'm watching Jurassic Park 3 and the little kid runs out and saves Alan Grant in like animal pelts from Velociraptors, when I saw that moment in the theater, my heart just sank. And what was kind of a dry experience for me turned into a kind of a nightmare experience, and I was just depressed for the rest of the day. Now, looking back, that movie is not a disaster. It's really not. It's not a bad movie. It's not a great movie, but it's really not bad. It's mostly a case of my expectations and my oddly specific fears, you know, being met in a particular way. Because of that, even though, again, it's not a disaster of a movie, it is still, it's not a great movie. You can tell the script is basically made up as they go. But it's it was a disappointing outing for me.
That's really interesting because I actually, for whatever reason, had a really positive response to Jurassic Park 3, and I think it was because I looked at it as a bit of a recovery for the franchise after what happened with what was almost the second movie on my list, The Lost World, the movie that you love so much, and that was just such an empty experience for me, and I look back on these summers, and I think back on some of the movies that I liked at first, but look back on and really hate today after revisiting or just realizing that I was a young kid duped by the marketing and I just got swindled into liking something before I even actually saw the movie. And I think Lost World could have been one of those, but it wasn't. That I think at that point I realized that this just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like Jurassic Park or even Spielberg for that matter. I know you see it a completely different way, but still to this day, The Lost World just doesn't hold up. But it's not on this list. If this were a top 10, maybe, but it is completely overshadowed by something else from 1997 from Warner Brothers, Batman and Robin.
Oh, man.
Joel Schumacher's second Batman movie, if you want to call it that. I mean, they weren't really even marketing it as a Batman movie, for God's sakes. Arnold Schwarzenegger was at the top of the poster and got top billing for the thing. Batman was an afterthought with the whole thing, and he may as well have been too. I mean, just seeing this movie, it's just, I don't really know what it is, to be honest with you, and I'm a fan of Batman Forever. I really liked it. I got wrapped up in the marketing of that movie too, but I like the movie, and I go back and watch it, and there's so much to really enjoy about what Joel Schumacher was doing, this new flair and this sort of vibrancy that he was bringing to it, this once and previously completely thought of as such a dark character in Bruce Wayne and Batman, and the humor he brought to it with the third Batman movie and Batman Forever. I just, for whatever reason, I bought in at the time, and I still enjoy that movie to this day, but man, I went to the Bama Six in Tuscaloosa here in town on opening day to see Batman and Robin. Was pumped for whatever reason. I didn't get it, I guess, when the previews were coming out. I guess I thought that there was still hope just because it was a Batman movie that I was seeing in theaters on opening day, and it was just such a major disappointment, one that I knew even when I was only 12 years old. I just knew this sucks, and it has to get better soon.
Yeah, it's definitely my number one. It wasn't just that I liked Batman Forever. It was also that it was, Batman the Animated Series had been on for a few years.
Yep.
And Mr. Freeze was such a great character on that show, and Superman the Animated Series had started, and it was just this time of, and there were rumors out there of Superman Lives being made. So it was this time of like, ooh, maybe we're on the cusp of like something really great. Bane was in the trailers. That's one of the only movies I've ever had to go see again just to confirm that it was as awful as I was afraid it was. It might be one of those that burned me on movies in a way forever. That may have been my growing up moment where I realized that, wow, things can go this wrong. Like, and it's, I was, 14. 13, about to turn 14. I definitely think that was a maturity moment where I realized that, okay, well, I guess when things are bad, I might be able to notice from now on.
Yeah, and Batman is a thing when you're a kid that you think it's always going to be great.
Yeah, how could you possibly dislike Batman?
Well, right.
They figured it out.
And that's just like raw disappointment right there.
Oh, yeah.
When you go see a Batman movie and it's not good and you don't love it or like it even, and You mentioned the animated series. I was all in on that, too. And Mask of the Phantasm had come out at that point, right? And so,
It was a couple years before.
And so there was a theatrical Batman movie not too long ago that we loved. And I think that really, I mean, we had seen the Burton Batman movies, and, I loved both of those. But once, I was watching the animated series in the afternoons after school, you start to realize the real true potential of this character, and that's when I personally really started going for Batman and really vying in as one of my favorite characters in movies, television, or whatever medium he happened to be a part of. And for this, with so much hype following the third and very successful movie, and again, you know, all of the marketing that was just, you know, that bombarded us, it was just such a disappointment. And, you know, it should have been a warning sign from the get-go that Arnold Schwarzenegger was playing Mr. Freeze. You know, I love Arnold Schwarzenegger and his action movies and everything, but I do kind of remember at the time thinking, this doesn't really feel right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a cool Terminator vibe, you know, to a Mr. Freeze that you could do, but that's not what they did.
No.
And it's what you're saying is actually related to, I won't go there. I was gonna open the James Bond book, but those aren't really summer movies. So what's your that was kind of my second one. What's your last one?
Well, it has to be The Phantom Menace, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be.
It's not one of mine, but it would probably be in my top 10 if I had to make a top 10.
Well, it's got to be just kind of like universally thought of as the biggest disappointment in movie history. Right? I mean,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, or, I mean, I guess the prequels generally, you know, because again, at the time when I saw this movie, I thought it's good, right? Like, it's still really good even after the movie was over and after, you know, all of the warning signs and the opening seconds of the movie had already occurred, I decided to block all of it out. And by the end of it, after the Darth Maul fight and everything, and I guess the pod race and the elements that, you know, we can glean from it that we consider positive and good about that movie, I walked out of it saying, no, I guess it's good. I need to see it again. And once I saw it again, it all just clicked. And the gloss just went away. And I, along with the rest of the world, just realized what a crap fest it actually was and what had happened to this precious entity known as the Star Wars saga has just been sullied by its creator, you know. And we've talked about this, the tarnished legacies thing, on previous episodes of Film Nerds Unlimited and on my show Aspect Radio, but my goodness, when it actually happened in the moment, it just left such an empty feeling in me, and I wanted to look forward to the remaining sequels to come, but it just started on such a dour and disappointing note that it just changed not only the Star Wars hype and potential and prospect that I saw as a young moviegoer, but it kind of changed how I looked at movies forever and summers and knowing that there, you know, you can look forward to any of these summer movie seasons and big movies that you can't wait for, and they may be great, but there's always going to be the potential for severe disappointment, and you might walk out of that theater angry and frustrated and even a little sad.
Yeah, it is. We open ourselves up to it, man, and it is bizarre. And kind of this is basically the same scenario as Batman and Robin, but Spider-Man 3 is one of mine where you go in and you're like, how can they mess this up? You know, I mean, the first movie was pretty good. The second one was really good. And they had so many loose storylines that they could go in, so many great directions they could go into. And then I've talked about this too already before, is that during Spider-Man 3, it's just all these things kept happening that I was like, wait, what? It's kind of like I imagine being shot to death by a BB gun, where like you start feeling it and you're like, oh, come on, that's really annoying. And then you start realizing you're bleeding and you're like, whoa, hold on, wait. And then you realize that, yeah, you're losing an awful a lot of blood. And that's kind of how I felt halfway through Spider-Man 3. And then I was just, there's a turning point with a dancing, a Marvel superhero dancing, which is never a good sign. And
they still do it.
I know. And it's the sign of that they've lost control. And in Spider-Man 3 is the most egregious. And it's The feeling after Spider-Man 3 was like being broken up with by like the girl of your dreams, basically. And I remember before the movie, people had told me that it wasn't very good, and I wouldn't believe them. And then I went to see it, and it was crushing. And it's one of those things where the conversations I had after that with people, it was like we survived something together. And it's super tragic. So,
well, I didn't see Spider-Man 3 in the theater. I was not a huge fan of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. I mean, I thought that they were good, but I definitely was not as gaga about them as other movie fans, and especially comic book fans who thought that we were finally seeing a superhero on the big screen like we always wanted to. I didn't feel the same way, and so I skipped out on Spider-Man 3 at the theater, and I visited it for the first time. I watched it for the first time, and during the first hour, I thought, this is not as bad as everybody says it is. It's actually
exactly
really well-paced, and the set pieces are really good, and the special effects are as seamless as ever. But then he started dancing.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's I've gone back and watched it, and it's really, I mean, there are definitely things to like about it. And there's definitely some really cool set pieces. But yeah, the bad stuff is so bad that it's still painful.
You didn't feel the same way when Star-Lord starts dancing during the opening credits of Guardians of the Galaxy?
No, because I don't have any connection to that character, and because they'd already set up that character has a certain connection to pop culture.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's entirely, it's two different things.
So dancing it's not a complete deal breaker for you, but Spider-Man dancing.
Yeah, I guess at that point I didn't consider Star-Lord a superhero. I mean, he was kind of played as a joke before that, so. It's not one of the major, it's not Reed Richards, or somebody like that.
Right.
Or Iron Man being made a fool of.
Right.
Somebody that hasn't been set up yet.
Who has danced in two Iron Man movies.
All right, well, did you have any honorable mentions in addition to those kind of big three?
I do, for sure. And these could have easily wound up on the list. They're not as big, for sure. I mean, there are a couple of releases that are similar in terms of the prestige that surrounded them, but others are just kind of more personal picks that disappointed me or just like didn't live up to my high and very young expectations. I saw these movies when I was too young anyway, but one is from 1997, Disney's Hercules. It was one of the first 2D animated Disney movies that really just didn't do it for me. You could kind of see it coming, I think, with Pocahontas and Hunchback of Notre Dame. Those are two movies that I really like a lot, but
yeah,
they certainly are not on the same level as obviously movies like The Lion King and Aladdin and part of that just golden age of 2D Disney animation in the early 90s. But Hercules was just a big disappointment. I hated the design, the music. It just didn't do it for me. And obviously Godzilla, the Roland Emmerich 1998 version was just a massive disappointment for everybody. And the same
I loved
true
it
for me. You
I loved
it.
I loved it.
Why?
I think it's so much Jurassic Park meets Aliens.
Yeah, but without the good movie stuff.
Yeah, well, with like the simple cheap stuff of those movies. I mean, I'm not gonna say that movie is good, but I like it. Like, I don't know.
Sounds like you're saying it is as good as Jurassic Park and Aliens.
No, well, let me totally
backtrack.
Back off. Yeah, let me make clear that I am not saying that, because that would be a bad thing to say. What I'm saying is that it took the certain things about Jurassic Park and Aliens, specifically raptor kind of, dinosaurs, or a big dinosaur, or, monster action scenes that happen in the rain. Like, those things from Jurassic Park they took. And then they took, like, the military guys, going to find, this monster kind of buried underneath this stuff, and it could pop out at any time. And again, the stuff in Madison Square Garden, where they're kind of running away from these hordes of these things, kind of from aliens. I have a soft spot for that, like, late 90s CGI creature feature kind of thing, like Godzilla and Starship Troopers, which I know a lot of people like just as a movie. But those kind of where the studios were like, oh, wow, we can make, like, Carnosaur, but put CG in it and then put it in the theater. So I guess that's kind of what I like about it, and it's that on the biggest scale. And it's super dumb and it's super audacious. And now that I've kind of become a more cultured fan of the Godzilla franchise, yeah, I totally see that it's a bastardization of that entire thing. But yeah, at the time I liked it a lot. I was 15 and, I was like, yeah, this is totally fine. And now that, and I've seen, I never saw Hercules at the time, but I saw it recently, and yeah, the story is not so good, but a few of the songs are pretty catchy, so.
If you say so, man, you must be into Go the Distance, but not...
Hell yeah, man, Michael Bolton.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah, so another big one, two more big ones before I get to the small ones. Cars in 2006, just the disappointment of there being a Pixar movie that wasn't good or that I just didn't personally like. And it stands to this day as the worst Pixar movie for me and just a really disappointing experience. I mean, as soon as, you know, Sheryl Crow and Rascal Flatts and all of these songs started playing as these cars just, these Chevron-inspired designs that John Lasseter lifted from television ads started just streaming across the screen. It just really felt wrong, and the winning streak had just ended, you know, and come to a screeching halt. And that was just such a major disappointment that this studio that had given us so much finally had a blemish. And that's not to, you know, that's not to crap on Pixar too much because of the batting average that it does have. It's obviously pretty you know, unparalleled in the industry. So I'm forever thankful for, you know, Toy Story. If they had started there and stopped there, then I would have been forever thankful for Pixar. But that was just, it was just disappointing. Just that, you know, the dream was over. And in 2008, the one that I've been kind of avoiding here and could be number one on any other day, I went for a midnight screening, and it has to be the worst midnight screening I've ever been to.
Are you about to talk about Iron Man? Dude,
I wish. You
I
wish,
you liked that
maybe.
Movie.
No, it's The Dark Knight. No, I'm kidding. It's Indiana Jones and
Mama Mia.
Crystal Skull. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I know that you like this movie because you're a weirdo, but
uh-huh.
I mean, what I said about Phantom Menace times two, you know, like rinse and repeat. It's just the same exact thing pretty much. I mean, we fooled ourselves and it fooled us into thinking that it was going to recapture this magic that really made people and film nerds like you and me fall in love with movies. And Indiana Jones was just such a huge part of our lives, our young movie-going lives, and became so synonymous with movies generally that we couldn't help but mark out, so to speak, or just get too excited for another Indiana Jones movie directed by Steven Spielberg. It was too good to be true, and it obviously turned out to be that way. And again, I'm sure it's nothing new to you to hear somebody just berate this movie and you know, the studio and Spielberg and George Lucas for making it happen the way that they did, but it needs to be said. It needed to be said. The other honorable mentions I have are kind of like the smaller, more obscure ones that just are their personal picks. Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey didn't live up to the first movie's success and hype. I don't know what to say. It was just such a huge disappointment.
Who would have thought that going the Seventh Seal route wouldn't have worked for that franchise?
Yeah. I don't know. Something seemed off. It didn't work for me. Another sequel that bummed me out, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid from 1992.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I mean, following just a children's film masterpiece with Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, just one of my favorite all-time family movies. And I don't know. It just, again, it's like you just get a weird feeling watching these movies, even as a kid, and you start to get jaded by sequels early in your life, as often as we went to the movies. And it was just a really disappointing feeling. Angels in the Outfield from 1994 just couldn't live up to Little Big League, the baseball movie that came before it that year, and Rookie of the Year the year before. Johnny Mnemonic from 1995, I saw this late, I think, on a Friday night at the Fox 12 in Tuscaloosa, And yeah, it was just weird. I feel like I need to go back and revisit Johnny Mnemonic, because the only time I've ever seen it was in 1995 when I was 10 years old.
Also, that's the only time anybody has ever said those words. I need to revisit Johnny Mnemonic.
Under Siege 2, Dark Territory from 1995. Also there with Johnny Mnemonic. What a disappointing pairing. And yeah, these are movies that disappointed me greatly when I was 10, 11, and 12 years old in my young movie-going life. And look, I mean, maybe they deserve second looks, but I don't know. It would be hard for me to look them in the eye even today.
Well, I definitely think if you gave Under Siege 2 another look, you should probably watch it with a kid that would be the same age as you were then and kind of see if it would, you know, hold up for him. Because that's exactly the age of kid that needs to watch Under. Right?
Well, look,
how old were you?
For Under Siege 2, I was 10 years old. And
okay.
I saw Under Siege 1 in the theater, too, I believe. And it was awesome. It was just one of the most awesome theatrical movie-going experiences I can remember. And it's also one of those rare things, a good Steven Seagal movie, like a legit good Steven Seagal action movie, one of my favorite action movies of all time. And to get, you know, more adventures in the tumultuous and dangerous life of Casey Ryback, the you know, Special Forces soldier turned chef. It just seemed too good. Again, another thing that was too good to be true, and it turned out to be true, because, I mean, you're talking about following up a movie where Tommy Lee Jones and Gary Busey are the bad guys, the adversaries for Steven Seagal, and you replace them with Eric Bogosian.
All I remember about Under Siege 1 is, I think, doesn't Sam Neill get his eyes gouged out?
No, or Tommy Lee Jones does. Spoiler.
Oh, it's Tommy Lee Jones. Oh, wow, spoiler. Yeah.
Sam Neill was in Hunt for Red October, though.
Oh. Maybe I'm kidding. I think I'm totally getting those two movies confused. I've never seen...
You love, dude, that's McTiernan, man. You disrespect
McTiernan.
No,
I definitely know that Sam Neill is in Hunt for Red October, but I haven't watched it, like... I didn't watch it, like, in adulthood until a few years ago. So when I was a kid, I think I probably walked in and out of my dad watching those two movies like on one weekend, and they could just kind of merge together. So I walked in and saw Sam Neill, which I think that would have been pre-Jurassic Park, so he wasn't on my radar. And then the next night I walked in and I saw Tommy Lee Jones getting his eyes gouged out, and they're both in a submarine. So I think I probably just did the 9-year-old math.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's funny with...
I mean, I think, I mean, it's sounding to me like we need to do a Steven Seagal Film Nerds Unlimited, because I don't think I've even seen any Steven Seagal movies except for Exit Wounds.
Oh,
and
my God.
Oh, I saw Cradle 2.
Jeez, the grave? Like, the
Cradle
2. The grave.
Right, it's Cradle 2. It's the sequel. Cradle 2.
The grave. Cradle 2, colon, the grave?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay, so we're talking about Steven Seagal here, so I'm guessing that he's nothing but a punchline to you. He made some good movies in the late 80s and early 90s, including Under Siege, Marked for Death, Hard to Kill. Come on, man, catch up.
Hey, I have no opinion on Steven Seagal. I'm saying it sounds like I need a primer, like a course, to kind of show me where I need to, you know, fill in the gaps of my Steven Seagal viewing.
Yeah, well, real quick tidbit on Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, this big summer disappointment for me. I didn't learn this until recently, that Matt Reeves of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was a co-writer on this movie.
Yeah, I think that was his first kind of break.
Yeah, he talked about this on the Q&A podcast with Jeff Goldsmith. Really interesting. I don't even think this was supposed to be an Under Siege movie until they just slapped the title on it.
Wow, it's kind of like Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Exactly.
That
worked out a little better, though.
A lot better.
Yeah, not on
So, going back a little bit, I don't know. Like, I think I totally empathize with your Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull experience, because I think I remember talking to you about it, like, shortly thereafter, And, like, there was, like, a long pause, and then you were like, it was a nightmare. And I was like, ooh, wow, a nightmare. Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
So I think I totally understand that feeling, because that's the feeling that's that feeling that we're talking about when you have something that is supposed to make you happy. It's supposed to be, you know, a part of an enjoyable time of year when everything's sunny and fun. And then you kind of realize that you're stuck with something awful that you hate.
Yeah.
I didn't have that experience with Indiana Jones, but I had that experience with Batman Robin, like we were talking about, and Spider-Man 3. I totally had that experience with Armageddon. I was on a Michael Bay high in 1998. It's kind of like an experience I would have a few years later with John Woo in Mission Impossible 2, where I watched The Rock between 1996 and 1998. I watched The Rock, like, you know, constantly, like every few weeks. It was just like this perfect movie. It's like the first movie where I was aware of how cinematography worked and how a camera angle, you know, a single camera angle can make you feel something like something inside your stomach. So I was a huge Michael Bay fan, and I loved Bad Boys, mostly because it had like cool looking cars. I don't know anything about cars, but Bad Boys has cool looking cars. And so I was, same summer as Godzilla, better movie than Armageddon. Same summer as Godzilla, I was there. Here's Bruce Willis, star of the Die Hard trilogy, which was one of my favorite things. And then here's this action director who's setting the world on fire, literally. And I was like, oh, this is it. You know, this is going to be the best movie ever. Like, this is going to be the experience for my teenage years in terms of, like, action movies. And then I started watching Armageddon same thing, midnight screening. And I remember there was, like, I think maybe Taco Bell had, like, merchandising tie-in with Armageddon or something. I remember seeing, like, the stand-up.
Right.
Yeah, I remember the cardboard stand-ups, and I was like, this movie. And I'd seen Deep Impact earlier in the summer, and I was like, that's fine. You know, it's a good teaser for Armageddon.
Right, but it's not going to be Armageddon.
Exactly. So we start watching this movie, and you get this schmaltzy garbage animal crackers.
Oh, come
on. You get the just fat guys screaming when asteroids are coming down. And I was like, well, you know, okay, so I don't like anybody in this movie. And it seems like all of the cool action stuff is being spoiled by these screaming jerks, you know, in the periphery of these scenes. But once they get to space, this movie's going to really take off. And then they get to space, and they land on the asteroid, and I couldn't tell what was going on. Everything is cut. Like,
The Rock?
Like, no, like a Meatloaf music video that they forgot to light. It's so frustrating to watch Armageddon, which should be this awesome. It's such a simple formula, and it should be so awesome. And then it's cut to ribbons. The Rock is heavily cut. I mean, especially that scene in the big open kind of commons area when, like, everybody is pointing a gun at each other and all the Navy SEALs die. And that scene especially, and there's a bunch of sequences in there that are cut to high heaven. But maybe it's because it's in a real location. Maybe it's because so much of it takes place during the day. Maybe it's because there's a light source other than the sun. Maybe it's those things that make the difference between what Michael Bay was doing in those two movies. But for me, Armageddon was just this incoherent mess. And the reason Godzilla is a better movie is because it's going for the exact same things, potentially more complex emotions than Armageddon is. And you can actually see it. You can actually see what's going on, and I can understand where the giant you know, Iguana is compared to Ferris Bueller. You can't do that in Armageddon. There's zero sense of geography, and
man,
that's all I want. That's
I
all
thought
I want from an action movie.
I thought Godzilla, I mean, I don't mean to make a crack on Gareth Edwards again here, but I thought it suffered from, we won't show you the monster until, you know, the last set piece, or like the last.
I'm talking about Roland Emmerich's Godzilla.
I am too. That's what I'm saying. Like I'm saying, like I.
Are you about to wait? Hold on. Okay, go ahead.
I'm saying, like, I'm not trying to make a crack on Gareth Edwards here. This is like inadvertent because he made the 2014 Godzilla, but
okay.
I thought that the 98 Godzilla suffered similarly from waiting way too long to show its hand with the monster. And
but then
just,
at least you had the stupid shallow Jaws ripoffs where it was setting things up, you know,
yeah.
Or Close Encounters where you at least had something
yeah.
to kind of, this kind of tension that was building. In Armageddon, the tension is Ben Affleck pretending a giraffe, he's an Australian and a giraffe is on Liv Tyler's belly. That
seems like a, that's like most Michael Bay movies, that scene is like literally 10 seconds long, maybe shorter. And we were prepped for that whole sequence because MTV was playing the Aerosmith song with that just shows footage from that scene pretty much like 100 times a day.
You know what pop song the Godzilla movie gave us? That Puff Daddy Jimmy Page song, which is comically bad, but at least it's entertaining. And it also
And the Wallflowers Hero.
And a pretty and my personal favorite Rage Against the Machine song too. So
Really?
Oh yeah, no shelter.
Yeah, and then they just piped in some Godzilla roars over a Green Day song that wasn't written for the movie, but
I hear that song, I have to do the Godzilla roars.
Oh God! Well, look, I mean, 98 was an interesting year for sure because you had the double down on the asteroid movies. And I like Armageddon. I think it's a really fun movie, and it probably is everything that you just said it was. But for whatever reason, as opposed to what Michael Bay does today, and maybe it foreshadowed the crap that we were going to get in the very near future, I liked it. I liked the action. I liked a lot of the comedy. I thought it played really well. I thought Bruce Willis was a solid lead. I thought the ensemble was fun. I thought the effects were good. I think the movie is actually stronger before they go up into space. You know, it does get
definitely
weird.
The best parts of it are like Billy Bob Thornton's scenes.
Yeah. He's really good, for sure. But, I mean, yeah, and I look at the rest of 1998. It is, there are a lot of disappointments, but, I mean, you toss in stuff like Saving Private Ryan, Lethal Weapon 4, Truman Show. I mean, there's a lot
there's
of
something
stuff.
Something About Mary?
Yeah, there's Something About Mary, fantastic. I mean, there are some good comedies. I like Can't Hardly Wait, actually. But, you know, another big disappointment from that year, May 1st, Graham and I, my brother Graham, who's also on Film Nerds Unlimited, we went and saw Black Dog, the Patrick Swayze 18-wheeler movie.
Yeah.
And I think Graham, he used to write for this thing called the Our Generation page for the Tuscaloosa News, which is basically like a youth page. And he wrote a review of Black Dog, and I feel like they printed this, a kid writing this review. And he said, Black Dog is the first movie where I'm sitting there watching it and actually contemplating suicide.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they get dark on you there. So I think Black Dog might be on Graham's list of disappointments for the summer.
Well, I'm glad he's doing better now. I remember I totally wanted to see Black Dog real bad, but I think it came out so early in the summer that I was still in school and it just wasn't, you know, I just couldn't like, I couldn't find time to make it out to Black Dog, which is maybe good for my life.
Yeah, 98 also saw the release of The Avengers, not those Avengers, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Which
was a huge disappointment.
Oh, you saw it? Okay.
No. I didn't see it, but it was just a huge disappointment that there would be something called The Avengers that wasn't the Marvel Avengers. You know, it's just such a mean tease to kids who don't know any better, never heard of this show from the 1960s or 70s, that it would exist was a huge disappointment. So that probably belongs on the list too.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I mentioned Mission Impossible 2 earlier, so I'll briefly say that it was the same Michael Bay kind of situation where I was so obsessed with a director and so totally on board with what he was doing. And in this case, it was it was going to be my favorite director at the time directing the sequel to one of my favorite movies at the time, which was Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible. And it's Mission Impossible 2 is not a terrible movie, but it's got the same kind of romantic issues that Armageddon does that I just don't want to see in an action movie in the summer. At least I didn't at that age, where it has this schmaltzy tango thing where they're kind of constantly Tandy Newton and Tom Cruise are kind of dancing around. And the opening scene, which was so heavily marketed in trailers of him kind of rock climbing, it has zero tension in the movie because he's just climbing to get to a voicemail. And the whole movie just feels real soft, and it doesn't have any of the audacious kind of craziness of Face Off or Broken Arrow or certainly any of John Woo's Hong Kong movies. So it was a big disappointment to me. It just felt kind of like a toothless thing. It was a real bummer.
I think we saw two different movies then, because I loved Mission Impossible 2, and at the time I was a huge John Woo fan. I mean, back in 1997, when Face Off came out, my research for that movie was watching the movie Crack Cocaine that is Hard Boiled and The Killer and brushing up on John Woo, and I had seen Hard Target in the theater too, so I had a sense of who John Woo was and what he did. But once I saw those movies, I mean, those were absolute game changers in terms of how I saw and perceived action movies. And I couldn't have been more excited about Mission Impossible 2 because he was at the helm of it. And I mean, the motorcycle chase at the end, like some of the shootouts in it that, you know, have the patented John Woo dove sightings. I mean, I really love that movie. I don't know, man. Like, it is really super dumb, but it just totally worked for me that summer. For me at the time, it was what action movies were all about. I think it stands tall in the Mission Impossible franchise, holds up to this day, despite the silliness of the plot and Doug Ray Scott's villain in the movie. I think it's great and a really great action vehicle for Tom Cruise. And, you know, again, I'll reference something my brother says constantly about this movie. It's a movie that we should pay very close attention to and love at face value because it's essentially a remake of Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious.
That's so cool that he knows that. That's so cool.
Yeah,
what a
right.
Cool guy.
And also, I mean, this thing, think about it, too. This movie was written by Robert Towne, man.
Well, so was the first one.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's awesome unto itself. But
yeah.
I happen to think
Hollywood legend Robert Towne, you know, screenwriting a Tom Cruise shampoo commercial where John Woo is working out, you know, how he can save his failing American movie career.
Hey, man, he wrote Days of Thunder, too.
That's a good movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Days of going to non-disappointment. Days of Thunder is one of the first times I remember really noticing the kind of marketing synergy of a summer movie.
Because Micro Machines.
Oh, yeah, and all over Mountain Dew. Like, every time, I think McDonald's may have had Days of Thunder branded stuff. And I was like, this movie's awesome. I don't even know barely what it's about, but it's amazing because it's everywhere I look.
Yeah, 1990 was an important year for me as a film fan, for sure, because, I mean, I that's when I started to go to the theater with some regularity. Not as hardcore as I would in, like, 93 and 94, 95, but 1990 I saw things like Back to the Future 2, Gremlins 2, the Dick Tracy, Days of Thunder, for sure. I mean, it was big. It was big.
Yeah.
I mean, there were disappointments in there, too. I mean, Jetsons the movie just couldn't live up to my expectations as a 6-year old, but, or I'm sorry, a 5-year old, but, you know, you win some, you lose some during the summer.
It's 1990 was huge for me too. Not because my family was at a point there where we couldn't go see movies hardly at all. Like we went maybe once a year. I was totally entrenched in getting the coming soon pamphlet from the video store, and trying to consume as much movie stuff as I could without actually getting to the theater. And yeah, I remember seeing stuff for Jetsons the movie, and the day my dad brought Die Hard 2 home for me to watch as a 7-year-old, I was like, oh yeah, here we
yeah.
go.
Well, you know, yeah. you know, Jetsons, the disappointment of Jetsons 2 was thankfully, it was vanquished by DuckTales the movie, which
Hell.
Came out later that year in August.
Absolutely. But that's it's so far from a disappointment that it's, I might even edit it out of the podcast that it would
yeah,
even be mentioned in something with, yeah, I mean, that's a masterpiece. All right, man. Well, thanks for talking, and yeah, maybe we'll... love to talk about more summer movie stuff in coming episodes.
All right, Ben. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, man.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.